for probably whatever you are pitching to us is something relevant. Sometimes founders come like, hey, I'm doing this to increase more consumption. You're like, oh, okay, I'm not sure if that's super relevant or if it's needed. When you come and tell us like, yes, the world is ending, especially thinking from like a climate perspective, it's getting much warmer, these are the solution. I think you really click that button and check that box really quickly.
Hi, and welcome to Move Fast and Fix the Planet. I'm your host, Michael Levick, professor of civil and environmental engineering at Stanford. I'm also an associate faculty director of STVP, the Stanford Engineering Entrepreneurship Center, where we empower aspiring entrepreneurs to become global citizens who create and scale responsible innovations. Of course, one of the biggest global challenges we face is climate change and the sustainability of our planet. In each episode of this podcast, we'll talk to a different expert about entrepreneurship in climate and sustainability and what's different about, if anything, from entrepreneurship in other spaces. Our guest today is Beji Yang, managing partner at 500 Global, an early-stage tech venture capital fund. Born in Brazil to Chinese parents, Beji leverages her multicultural abilities to actively secure promising startups and investment partners, with a particular focus on the Brazil-Latin American arm of 500 Global. She's experienced in initiating social business projects aimed at income generation, and she founded Brazil Innovators, an initiative dedicated to accelerating entrepreneurship in Brazil. She holds a BA degree in business administration from Fundação Getúlio Vargas and a master's from the University of Pennsylvania with a certificate in East Asian Studies. Beji's been featured in Bloomberg and Huffington Post, acknowledged for expanding the presence of 500 Global and actively increasing the portfolio of investments in Brazil. Welcome, Beji.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here today.
We're excited to have you. So I want to start off by understanding a little bit of how you do your work at 500. So you're a managing partner there, and you help to identify promising startups globally. You know, when you think about evaluating and supporting startups, particularly in the climate and sustainability space, what are the unique factors that you consider in this specific sector?
So when we look at the very specific feature on what we're looking for to invest in the startup, let me give you like a maybe like start with a general framework and we can hone in specifically to climate and sustainability. And is that sort of much different, right?
And that's actually a really important point of what we're wanting to discuss in this podcast. So I really appreciate you starting with the overall framework and then saying how it's different for the climate and sustainability. That's really great.
So when we look at the general framework, the first thing that we look at really is the team. And at 500 Global, we do early stage investment. So very often, we don't see even like a product launch. So the only data point that we have are the 2-3 people that are in front of us that are have this vision to build something. So the first thing, it's about a team. And the most important component here is the credibility of the team to build what they believe they can build. The second component that we really look at is the opportunity and how big that problem is. What are you trying to solve? So I think the beauty of thinking within the sustainability space into that is for probably whatever you are pitching to us, is something relevant. Sometimes founders come like, hey, I'm doing this to increase more consumption. You're like, oh, okay, I'm not sure if that's super relevant or if it's needed. When you come and tell us like, yes, the world is ending, especially thinking from like a climate perspective, it's getting much warmer, these are the solution. I think you really click that button and check that button really quickly or check that box really quickly because the problem is quite big and the very high level market opportunity is really great, right? The third thing that we look at is like, okay, what does it mean from the market opportunity? Like, can you capture it, right? Like, what is then your potential business model? How much are you going to be capture of that market opportunity? When we invest, that's one of a key factor as well, because you might not make money today, but we wanted to have a little bit of path to what economic outcome you might get to. I know you might be measuring additional sort of sustainable or climate or carbon sort of impact, but to be fundable from a venture capital perspective, it's quite important for us to understand how you're going to make money and what's your specific addressable market. The fourth thing we look at is, okay, you have a team. What's your early discovery? Sometimes you might or might not have traction. Sometimes you might or might not have like a pilot that you're looking at. But ultimately, even if you don't have a product that has been launched, we really want to understand your ideal customer profile. And then are they willing to buy what you are offering them? So ultimately, the understanding of the customer and that early discovery, potentially if you have traction, that would be ideal. And then the last point really is, what's the price of your startup today, right? Like, you can come and say, okay, it's amazing team, it's an amazing opportunity, you can make money out of it, you have good early discovery, but it's a $100 million sort of price tag for us to come in. Then we might consider, okay, do I invest now or can I come in a little bit later? And if I'm deploying, which I think is really important as well, right? If I'm deploying $100,000, $200,000 check at a $100 million valuation, from an investor perspective, is that worth coming in at that price? And does that fit in, which is something interesting when you think about venture capital, and is that, does that fit into that fund sort of investment thesis as well, right? So
yeah,
these are like the main factors and frameworks. And I think that really, like, when you break into each of them, then you would have the sustainability component. And then the last one that we look at, but 500 Global is not specialized in it, is like the metrics piece of the sustainable part that doesn't have like the other factors that I mentioned.
So I want to dig a little bit deeper on a couple of these to better understand what sustainability means in those spaces. So let's start with the first one when it comes to the team, right? And you said what we're looking for is credibility. What does credibility mean to you in the climate and sustainability space? You know, because is it a degree that has something related to sustainability in the title of the bachelor's or master's degree? Is it having worked as, you know, some kind of sustainability consultant? What does credibility mean in the climate and sustainability space?
Yes. So answering your question is yes. There are several factors that could be in. Like, one is your background. Like, what did you study? It depends a little bit on the startup. A lot of startups, deep tech has a lot of expertise and research sort of went into it. So I think in that case, that's particularly sort of important. Very often, if you're working a lot with commercialization of it, like being able to at least show, not that you have sold into those companies, but that you have that ability to build a team or you can do it. We normally recommend the founders in the first sale or the sales to up to $1 million for the founding team to be highly involved instead of, hey, I have this like salesperson doing it. It also could be very often when we think about the team credibility is, did they accomplish what they say they would within the time that they say they would, right? And let's say they say, hey, we're going to launch an MVP in the next 6 months, or we wanted at the beginning to launch an MVP in 6 months and it took them like 2 years to launch. Very often we want to try to understand something didn't hit the milestone they thought they wanted to hit. Like, what happened? Does that sort of hit the credibility component? And very often we start that day digging a little bit deeper on questions, like knowing your industry, knowing your metrics, knowing the answer, like that is really important. So I think there are a lot of ways to look at the credibility component. But for us, for instance, it's not very important, like which school you went to, especially because for context, 500 Global has invested in over 80 countries and the founders come from all different backgrounds.
Sure. Well, and so what I'm hearing from you in this is that, you know, the credibility piece is still very much about, do you have the appropriate background to address the technology, to address the space that you want to go into? That if you're going to do deep tech, you're probably going to want to see a more technical background. If you're going to go into a business innovation, it might be more of a marketing and business growth type of background. And the sustainability piece is something that gets layered on top of that, rather than saying you want somebody with a full degree in sustainability and then moves into the space that they're looking at. That credibility still starts with, do you understand the problem you're attacking?
For sure. And also, I think other sustainability layers, sometimes people bring advisors, right? Like they might or might not need to be independent. If it's a deep tech, I think you mention, and that's like really the case. But I think outside of deep tech side, very often you can get like advisory people that could be like very essential, but I don't see like it always needs to be like someone who has a degree or has to have work in the specific sector before, sure. Right? Like if they have proven like they could implement something, could be at a corporate, could be in a different case component, but we can relate that, oh, it seems that they can execute their plan, then I think that becomes quite interesting for us to consider investing.
Totally, totally. All right, now I want to move on to the next component that you had talked about, opportunity, and whether the opportunity is big enough, right? Now, as a founder, I can come in and say, I want to tackle climate change, which of course is a big opportunity. But as we all know, a startup has to have focus, right? And so how do you balance the, I want to fix climate change against, you cannot boil the ocean, so to speak. And so, you know, how do you think a founder or an investor should ride that sort of difficult chasm of, okay, I'm addressing this, you know, existential challenge of the world, but I've also got to actually build a business where I know what I'm doing and can operate. And so what does it mean to be, you know, how do you connect those two things?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. Like, I think the worst interviews or IC calls we have, it's founders that comes in and they say, I want to change the world. And it's like, how are you going to change the world? And they say, oh, I want to create a lot of impact. I was like, okay, I understand. Yeah, the problem is really big. I was like, okay, but how are you going to do it? Mm-hmm. So I think maybe answering is like, how do you focus and how, like, when does it become relevant from like a bottom up perspective? I think the founders not necessarily need to have what eventually is going to scale, because very often they haven't launched the product yet, right? So a lot of it is in their assumption. But I think what we try to test there on the market opportunity and then the addressable market and then how they're going to get their first customer is really their assumptions, right? Like, is it credible of the assumption that they have? So I'll give you an example. So they can come in and then say, okay, we wanted to solve the climate issues. Are we going to launch an app that people are going to download and then people are going to use it? And it's going to be with like eventually to like a million active users. And then they're going to pay us a high amount of money because we find sustainable product for them, right? Okay, so let's say that's the very specific product that they can solve it. Then at least they have like an assumption there. I think the biggest question then, answering your question, is like, how do we assess if that's a good opportunity? The main question that I will ask, like if you're starting like this type of business, I'll ask the founders like, okay, you have an assumption that everyone is dying to like buy like a product that it's sustainable. So I think that's a pretty big assumption. So if you have that big assumption and say, okay, this is a big market, everyone wants to do it, everyone's going to jump in and download or buy or adopt, I need some sort of validation, whether from a customer or whether from like a few interviews that I've done, that is not your mother, not your father, sort of interview, to say, okay, it seems that your hypothesis sort of makes sense. So I think how you build from top level opportunity to can I build a potential product or addressable market is getting some sort of hypothesis and validation of those hypotheses that what if those are true or prove true to be?
Hmm. Yeah, no, that makes a great deal of sense. And we know that these types of hypothesis-driven sort of startups that look to propose a hypothesis, test it, and then move forward are really a good, stable way to try to move forward. So the other piece that I think is uniquely different in this space, and which you mentioned, is metrics.
Yeah.
And the kind of metrics that you would expect a startup to be tracking in order to get some credibility, once again, around whether or not you're actually a climate or sustainability focused firm. And if possible, you know, what are those metrics and how do you see those relating to LPs?
Mm.
And are LPs that are coming into the fund now, are they asking about climate and sustainability focused components of the portfolio? And what kind of metrics are they asking for? Mm. And how does that then sort of, I guess I'd say, you know, cascade down to the level of what you're telling your startups that they need to track?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think when you think about venture capital, we serve our founders, but we also serve our investors. So maybe we'll start with the investors, and then we can talk a little bit about like the metrics that we require our founders. So I think the first thing to consider here, and to answer your question, is a little bit of like everything is like it depends, right? Like specifically for 500, we have not told our investors that we are like a climate or sustainability or like a social fund. Like when they invest in us, because they believe in our investment thesis, being a global company, build a large portfolio, build sort of portfolio at exit. So they believe in a certain thesis with that frame.
And the only outcome connected with that thesis, at least for 500 at this point, is one of economic return to the LP.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Although, because we're a global fund, we're first check to the founders, a lot of people feel like we are creating a lot of economic development.
Sure. There are externalities. Yeah, there's externalities associated with the benefit, which is why they believe in the thesis. But it's not something you necessarily report on and promise that you're going to deliver as part of the LP agreement.
That's exactly correct, right? But I think answering your question maybe is for funds, we raise current fund, and is there a sentiment of a capital wanting more climate, or would we raise more money if we have more deals in climate, or is that the sentiment that we think is good? The data recently have shown like more and more funds in climate funds have been able to raise funds, which wasn't the case, I want to say maybe like 3 years ago. There was like a gap, like where it was really hard to pitch LPs to say, hey, I'm going to do a climate fund. Now it feels, over the past 3 years, it feels like more and more funds and capital is interested in the space. And then some investors, some institutional investors are asking more on like, okay, I don't know about like every single data, but like it would be interesting if you have, for instance, like an ESG framework. And then within the ESG framework, then you have the environmental, the social, and the governance component. And then that trickles down to, okay, what does that mean? Let's say if my fund, and some of our funds have like gotten in the compromise to do the ESG, the most important piece is not like what is the right metrics. The most important component is, are you measuring it? And are you improving upon what you are measuring? And I think that's really, really important, because I think the biggest, maybe like, almost like a fallacy that on metrics we can do is sometimes we look for perfection on metrics. But at the early stage, it's really, really hard to be precise on. Like sometimes you can, but then it's like a small percentage that are like really good and have time, or there are very good ways to capture the data, right? Because you might be creating good outcome from like a non-financial piece, but like, are you measuring? Like you're worried about implementation, you're worried about building the team, you're building, like there's so many things to worry about. So I think when we think at 500, when we think about metrics, we try to not overcomplicate too much the metrics. And that it could be something when we are measuring, it could be like, okay, jobs created. It could be around gender. It could be like, okay, if you can, like, are there different components on like carbon that you can measure? Sometimes we are really lucky to invest in a company that their core is really has a direct correlation with sustainability, right? Like, I'll give an example. We invested in a company called Ethic. And then what Ethic does is they are a platform for people interested in sustainable investing. So every single client they onboard, it means that they're increasing AUM for people investing in deals and instruments that are related to sustainable investing. So that's very easy to measure, right? Sure. Because it literally means that every time they onboard a new client, there are like new capital allocated. They might not be there or might otherwise not be. But I think except for this rare occasion that we end up finding deals like this, it's a little bit of an indirect metric. And we don't overstress, but we highly recommend founders start measuring because you can improve upon what you don't measure, right?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the things that I teach in my accounting classes is that you have to balance the value of what you're measuring against the cost of measuring it. You know, every time you introduce a new metric of success, you have to pay to track it. And whether that is assigning that activity to some employee that takes up part of their workday and therefore part of that full-time employee's, you know, cost, or whether it's hiring an outside firm, some type of third party to measure and validate, just the way we hire, you know, EY or KPMG from a financial standpoint, measuring more accurately is always involves a cost burden. Yeah. And so the question is, what is the value of doing that, particularly when it comes to time with a founding team?
For sure.
And so therefore, you know, what I'm hearing you saying is that, yes, you ask founders to start doing it, but to not go too far down the road of it has to be perfect, because we know these numbers are not going to be perfect from the outset. And we're not even sure that from your standpoint, the LP is going to find them to be all that important to their decision making.
At least our LPs.
Sure,
and important. And I think that's really important, right? I think from a founder perspective, from like the listeners, it's really important to understand like which capital you're trying to bring in and like what value can they add, right? And how do you want to do the composition of the investors that's going to be, or investors that who are going to be part of your journey.
So one of the other things that we've talked with a couple of the other guests about is exits in this space, and whether or not there's a difference in the way we should think about liquidation events in climate and sustainability space. You know, a good number of them are focusing on what are functionally commodity industries, whether that's foodstuffs, whether that's energy, whether it's things like this. And of course, commodity industries are not known for having super high gross margins. They're not known for having these huge equity bumps when they go to IPO or things like this. How are you thinking about potential exit strategies around investments in these kinds of firms? Because, you know, I know the folks at 500 have to think about, you know, down the road, what's the liquidation event going to be, and is there an opportunity here? Do you think about that differently in this space, or not yet at this point?
Not yet at this point, because there's no, like exit is not something we control, right? It's controlled by externality, and externality can be like interest from like IPO market into certain companies, or interest from a company to acquire into a certain space. So like we have no control on the exit. We can say, oh, is the market maybe moving towards acquiring more sustainable or companies that creates impact, right? So I think today we don't look at companies differently. We say, oh, because this company has a climate or a sustainable component, therefore we would apply the lens of exit differently. But I do think that we try to understand, and very often we're pretty lucky at 500 that we actually talk to a lot of policymakers, because a lot of policymakers are, like, we're in 80 countries, and like some of the countries we're in, we have like 100, 200 deals. So we're transforming like the economy in a lot of senses. So they're really trying to understand like, okay, what should I do for my economy to be like pretty innovative? What I think at the policy level, because I think the structural change very often needs to come at the policy level, right? Is there a better liquid market for certain companies, right? And the other partnership that could be done, maybe more at the private level, is from a collective corporate consciousness to buy more of these companies, right? But I do think like it requires more of like a group effort than like individual firms. I think right now from individual firms, I think a lot of firms are joining groups of like ESG coalition, like how do we best do things? I do think there's a lot of intention towards that direction, but I don't think it's actionable for us to say, okay, now I'm going to do this deal and I can go into like an IC and feel confident like, all right, I'll vouch for this because this, like, in addition to all, like, I know, like, they don't hit the team, they don't hit the metrics, they don't hit the market, but, you know, we think because of this sustainable, like, it clicks one of the box of, like, climate, therefore we're going to be doing this deal, right?
Yeah, no, there are myriad things that can happen between your investment committee meeting and liquidation that can, that can go one way or the other. Yeah. So you just talked about 500 being active in 80 different countries, right? Which is remarkable. As you think about identifying and supporting startups in each of those, maybe with a focus on environmental and social impact, do you see different trends in different areas around the globe? MENA versus LATAM versus Asia versus, you know, North America?
Oh, yes. So we are in 80 countries, and then we have almost 3,000 companies in portfolio. So it's a very broad portfolio that we have. And we are really active today, like over 300 deals in Southeast Asia. We're very active in like the US, Silicon Valley. We're very well known because of that. But also like the top three markets that maybe I can cover a little bit more is Latin America, Asia, thinking a little bit from like a Southeast Asia emerging market perspective, and then Middle East. Right now, we're seeing, like, think about like trends, we see a lot of sort of common thread of interest related to climate subsector, for instance, in like food system, like anything from like production to getting to the final customers. And depending on the region, it might be a different format because, for instance, very often for Southeast Asia, they are the producer. So in Indonesia, one of the largest sort of producer of like aquaculture component. So we invested in a very, very great deal called eFishery, which is like a collective for like improving the production of fish. But that same business can, of course, never be transferred to the Middle East. So I think like the nuance like really goes into like, okay, everyone's interested in food system, but what they can do to provide solutions very different. In Middle East, for instance, which is a market I've been like extremely active, we see a lot of interest in food security. So they would, as investor, invest in a deal, for instance, like if you're in Asia, but that type of deal wouldn't be like started in the region. We see, it's really interesting because, of course, Middle East, especially the Gulf countries, are oil-rich. And I think there's a lot of effort to try to understand what are maybe the opportunities or the real risk on the energy transition. and I think they navigate as, like, the oil price continue to rise, so I don't have to do anything, to, oh, wait, a lot more Teslas and EVs are on the road. And if more of that is to happen, then like, is there at least for that session of like cars, do we still have a space for it? Right. So it has like a little bit of like that component on what we've seen in climate in the Middle East. And then we see a lot of companies, and I've done some investment in companies that try to do more around like food and beverage supply chain optimization. And so I think that's a little bit more on Middle East. And then going a little bit to Latin America, what I think has been quite interesting in Latin America has been around, they're also like a big sort of food producer exporter. So I think there's also like a lot of interesting companies in the space of like, what are the alternative for some food or some meat? And then there are also like interesting companies that tries to serve optimization within the farming, which I think are interesting business models. So definitely you see that difference. And then when you come to the US, then you see a lot more deep tech. So it's quite broad and different.
Yeah, it's interesting that what you're saying, and it's probably not surprising, is founders tend to work on problems that are real to them and they know. And investors tend to invest in founders who are working on problems that they feel comfortable with. And so in Southeast Asia, where you're talking about aquaculture, you're talking about seafood, that's a big piece of food production
for sure
in Southeast Asia. When we shift to the Middle East, where there is, of course, heavy reliance in the past on fossil fuel production, they're trying to be innovative, both within the energy sector and that transition of it. You know, then if you go to LATAM, like you said, you know, that's where a lot of beef production still takes place. And they're trying to understand how they can shift protein production away from beef to think about it in new and different ways. And then, here in the US and in particular Silicon Valley, it's tech.
Yeah.
And so I guess, you know, what you're saying sort of fits with what is maybe the naive assumption that people work on what they know, that says it's maybe not so naive. It's actually true that that regionally you see specialization into trying to solve the problems that people know best.
And I think to add a layer, for sure they work on problems you know the best, but also they need to understand what is the economic opportunity on top of it. So for instance, I saw a very interesting company in Saudi. And they have hardware, actually. We normally try to, but they have a hardware that tries to understand water, sort of how much waste goes into like the water consumption. You're like, okay, that is a true problem because like there's not a lot of water. So that's an innate problem to its geography. But then what we found out later is like they wanted that to cost like $100. And then ask like, okay, but how much do people pay for the water bill? And they're like, oh, that's actually subsidized. We pay $1. And I was like, okay, wait, stop.
You're gonna have people, you're gonna charge people $100 in order to save three? That doesn't work.
It's not even like saving three, like they pay $1. So you might be like saving like 10 cents. I was like, stop. I don't like, so I think what's really interesting is that like layer of economic potential to capture that opportunity, right? So I think it really goes into what I was talking before, right? Okay, there's a big problem, but what is the solution that you are trying to tackle? And can you capture the opportunity like economically, of course? And then with that, like for instance, on the metrics for like how much water I save, that's pretty straightforward, right? Like, hey, like your normally consumption is this, now your consumption is that. Like that's the water you save. And it's great because from a sustainability sort of metric perspective, it's amazing, except I can't invest in a company that costs $100 with pre-production to like make that math work.
So what you're telling me is that if a founder is looking to go into the climate and sustainability space, their unit economics still have to make sense.
Yeah.
Without the added benefit of, you know, water savings, material savings, energy savings, CO2 reductions. It's a great story you're bringing up that hammers home a point that we have heard again and again and again on this podcast. Your unit economics still have to work because that is the business of business.
For sure.
Yeah. So I'd like to transition into another part of your background, because beyond traditional VC, you have experience in starting social business initiatives. How do you see the role of social entrepreneurship in driving climate and sustainability initiatives? And how do you think that startups can blend unit economics and profitability with these ideas of social entrepreneurship, social impact? Because we're starting to get to a lot of different outcomes that we want to see from each entity. And as you add more desirable outcomes, social, environmental, profitability, they're not always aligned and it gets harder and harder. So I think first off, what do you see? Yeah. What do you see the role of social entrepreneurship being going forward? And then what's the best way that people can balance all this?
Okay. So I think maybe that's a personal opinion, not backed by institution, not backed by anything else. My general approach, and I think that's a very personal, and I think when you're interviewing founders, understanding their vision, right? And what I try to measure when we're investing is the founding team. What I think very often people go into is their obsession to be perfect at everything. And I think that's the most difficult part to do. And then that will stop us. So I'll give you an example. And that brings from my social entrepreneur sort of background, right? So when we had a business that was helping different communities in the Amazon to build their economic prosperity, they were collecting products from the ground that were native to there. So it was the Brazil nut, and Brazil nut has the case outside of the Brazil nut, and people would throw that away. So they took those nuts, and then they were producing like really nice products, and that was really popular. And they would only take those products from the ground. So they wouldn't like, hey, I don't need this. I'm going to try to like throw all the nuts. It would like, they would fall on the floor. They would go around, they would collect, they would use it. And then it has a beautiful story behind it. It has a beautiful product.
But it was truly a waste product.
Yeah, it was truly a waste
product. Rather than just a diversion of some of the production towards something else.
Exactly. And then they were selling really well. And then there was a lot of demand on it. So there was an inflection point where the demand was so high that they actually don't have that product anymore. So they had like, they were trying to hit, okay, there's the social component because you were like empowering like a tribe. There was also like the sustainable component, and then you're the economic component. But sometimes the economic component is like so big that you undermine after that scalability on those two, right? And there are a lot of unintended consequences in some of the metrics that we try to do. And I think the best approach is to approach with the best intention. Like, I think sometimes like you don't want to say, okay, I don't care about this, or I'm like manufacturing like a data or anything like that. But like coming with the best intention to say, these are the three things we try to do, right? There's the profit, there's the purpose, there's also like the people, and then like there's a climate component. Let's try to work around it. Let's be flexible, try to understand how do we improve those. But I think if you start with saying, I want to do everything at the 10, like let's say it's 0 to 10, everything at 10 points, I think it stops us to move forward, right? So I think a lot of it is finding ways to capture the data on each of it, but also trying to understand a little bit on, it's okay to be a 2 and have a group discussion, like how do we improve from each of those items from 2 to 3? And very often, I think when you're getting money from investors don't expect you to be perfect, because we're investing in a startup with so much risk. A lot of it is like, what do you expect to accomplish? And then communicate to like, okay, these are the things that we need to pivot. These are like, we thought it would be like this, but we're not perfect in this sort of sense. So a lot of it is around communication. A lot of it is around like, how do you find a little bit of that balance? But ultimately starts with the intention. I think if the intention is there, then I think everything is possible.
Yeah. You know, you bring up a very interesting point, I think, as it relates to ventures of this type when it comes to scalability. You know, we always ask questions around demand scalability, meaning is the market big enough to grow into a huge number of customers? And so the question is, does the demand scale to a magnitude that makes this a $100 million annual recurring revenue type venture, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that we don't often think about is scalability on the supply side.
For sure.
right? And so in the example you just gave, you know, there just simply weren't enough waste nutshells to meet all the market demand. And there has to, of course, be a balance, because if all of a sudden they're buying, you know, nuts and cracking them and throwing away one piece and just using this other thing, that doesn't actually meet the goals of this sustainability-focused venture. And so it creates a much more difficult assessment when it comes to scalability of a market size. And I think that also, I'd love to hear your viewpoint on this, I think this also comes into to some policy questions, in that if certain types of ventures are receiving a significant tax subsidy or government subsidy in order to make their business model work, if they scale to significant sizes, the government is not going to want to continually offer more and more subsidy to support that growing business. At some point, the government will simply say, look, this is costing us too much.
Yeah.
You have to do this. And so how should we think about trying to balance both the demand side opportunity assessment with the supply side opportunity assessment?
Yeah, I think the venture normally worry about the demand side until the supply becomes an issue, right? Because they can't control on all levels. And very often, normally, we try to avoid investing in deals that requires policy, because you never know what the policymakers are going to do.
That is not an uncommon response on this podcast. Almost everyone has said, we try to invest in things that will be successful in the absence of a policy existing, and are only better because the policy exists for now.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, and I think it goes the same way even when you think about social enterprises that are trying to achieve an employment benefit for a specific group of people, when all of a sudden you've employed everyone that's possible out of that demographic, and you can't scale anymore if it's a tribal type enterprise that's in, say, the Amazon example that you just gave.
Yeah, and also I think it's like, particularly, you know, we talk about like the social piece. There are a lot of ways to make money, right? So, for instance, and that's also part of the reason I ended up transitioning doing something else at the time, because I was really passionate. We were like empowering 200-300 communities. But if you go and ask those people that were getting the money from the handicraft, you ask them, like, what would you like to do? They wouldn't say, like, oh, I would like to sell a lot of this product. They would say, like, I would like to have a job where I have security, and then I know tomorrow I have the money, and I have money for education and healthcare for my family. That's what they want, right? So sometimes you have this instrument that looks like really amazing, whichever instrument could be, right? Could be like a microfinance, or could be, like, they look really amazing, but ultimately it's a little bit of a painkiller to like a innate problem. So I think what made me think about on the social business component, I know like we could measure like the economic output or increase from what they have. Maybe they don't have anything else better to create that generation of income. But ultimately, I also thought, like, but if they have access to education and have access to like the workforce, they would be a lot happier, right? So then I took a step back. It's like, is there a better instrument to do something I wanted to do with that outcome in place, right? So if the outcome in place is climate, if the outcome in place is social, are you working on something that you truly believe that is the instrument that you feel like it's the platform that you want to be like driving, right?
Yeah. And I think you'd agree with the point that venture is not the ideal financing mechanism for all of these types of enterprises, given that sometimes other stakeholder metrics supersede financial outcomes in certain places. And therefore, like a VC model of financing isn't ideal. And then you shift over to other things, whether it's grants or some other type of funding.
For sure. Yeah. VC is definitely not for everyone.
without a doubt. All right, Beji, it has been fascinating to chat with you. But before I let you go, I have a series of questions that I'm asking to all of our guests. So we call it Four to Fix the Planet. And it's a chance for you to shine a spotlight on some things that are important to you and might be helpful to others. You ready?
I am ready.
All right. What's on your bookshelf, playlist, or feed right now?
I like to, on podcasts, like one podcast I really like is the Tech Talk, but they also have one that's TED Tech. Because the Tech Talk is about ideas worth spreading, but there's about everything and everything. And I like the TED Tech because it gives the changing the world for better a little bit with the tech component. So sometimes there are like very interesting things in that podcast that I like.
Very cool. What's keeping you up at night? What's something in this space that you think needs more attention?
People. I think we are so smart, like as humankind, as humankind, we're so smart. And if we really put the effort to solve something, it doesn't matter what it is, like we'll solve it, right? I just feel like we are not, like people don't care enough. I feel like it's a lot of convincing needed in the social component, the climate component. Like, so what keeps me at night is people who are not, like even sometimes people are in the industry, in the space, I feel like a lot of it's an ego, a lot of it is like other factors that drives them in.
Totally. What gives you hope? Something that's exciting or promising that you've seen in this space?
I really like the tech component. I think climate and social can be driven in so many layers and so many ways to do it. But the tech has reached a point where it accumulates on the knowledge and accumulates on things that we can do. So it gives me hope that if people can work towards the same direction, I think tech would be what accelerate. But if they don't know how to do that correctly, we are going into a destruction very quickly too. So that also keeps me up at night.
Sure. You know, that's why we named the podcast Move Fast and Fix the Planet.
I love that.
As a difference between the whole move fast and break things.
No more breaking things.
No more breaking
things. We can't afford with how quickly things sort of escalate.
Mm-hmm. Finally, what's your favorite sustainability hack? Something our subscribers could add to their day-to-day lives that you think would be helpful?
Yeah, I think everything it's often around habits. So when I think about like sustainability hacks, it's about habit. I'm really proud, really, really proud. I have two small kids and they both use cloth diapers. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people ask like, why in this generation, like, why don't you use disposable diaper? And what's the hack to it, right? Like, what's the sustainable hack for diaper? And I think the hack to it is when you approach a new habit, and I mentioned that I think 5 times in the podcast already, don't think that you will be a full-time person doing that. Like if everyone used disposable diaper, if I use one time cloth diaper, I'm happy. If I use during the day, but not at night, I'm happy. If I use it when I'm not travel or when I'm at home, not traveling, I'm happy. But eventually sometimes you would have it and then you get started and you're like, oh, it's actually not that bad. Oh, I can do it at night as well. I can do it when I travel. And then you really adjust your lifestyle around using certain sort of sustainable practice. So I think the hack is have something like you think, oh, that's something I really want to implement in my life. It doesn't matter what I want to implement in my business. I think sustainability is really important. I want to implement it in my business. I'm not going to be a full-time, really busy managing partner and changing cloth diapers. But you get to do it after you start, right? You make it work. So I think it all starts with, I think it's Atomic Habits from James Clear. He said, like, for you to do yoga every day, the first thing you have to do is put the yoga mat out, right? So I think it's just very simple. Creating good habits starts with, have the intention and then mm-hmm. start small. And then maybe you, after 2 kids, you can use the same diaper and wash it. And put all the shit out.
That's right. That's amazing. That's amazing. Well, finally, before we go, I just want to let all of our listeners know that you and I co-teach a really exciting program every summer here on the Stanford campus called VC Unlocked Silicon Valley. And it's a chance for us to educate emerging VC investors and angel investors on the fundamental mechanics of how venture capital works. And so for those that have enjoyed learning from Benji in this podcast, I'd certainly encourage you to think about checking out our course all about all of these types of topics as they relate to venture capital. Well, Benji, thank you very much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mike.
Today's guest has been Benji Yang of 500 Global. If you enjoyed this show, be sure to subscribe to Move Fast and Fix the Planet wherever you get your podcasts, and help others find it by rating, reviewing, and sharing it. Learn more about this podcast and related work at stvp.stanford.edu/sustainability. Move Fast and Fix the Planet is hosted by me, Mike Levick, and produced by STVP, the Stanford Engineering Entrepreneurship Center. This episode is supported by Stanford Ecopreneurship Programs. Our producers are Holly McCall and Anthony Ruth. Editing is by Stanford Video. For more podcasts, interviews, and articles, please visit stvp.stanford.edu/ecorner.